regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to be talking with Attorney Daniel Schmutter here in just a moment or two. He was arguing before the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals last week in a case that is trying to undo the federal ban on switchblades. One of the interesting things about this oral argument, the DOJ essentially arguing that knives may not be protected by the Second Amendment at all. And then yesterday, in other DOJ news, we saw the U.S. Attorney's Office for D.C., U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro, submit a brief in a case dealing with D.C.'s magazine ban, supporting an en banc review after a three-judge panel ruled that ban unconstitutional because it violates the Second Amendment. The U.S. Attorney's Office wants a rehearing, even though it's not prosecuting violations of the magazine ban, and even though ostensibly it agrees with the three-judge panel's decision, the brief from the U.S. Attorney's Office essentially invites the D.C. Court of Appeals to overturn that decision and does argue, actually, in favor of the district's registration scheme, as well as the statute regarding possession of unlicensed ammunition, I believe, is the charge, because you can only have ammunition in D.C. that fits the guns that are registered in your name. And the U.S. Attorney's Office is actually arguing in favor of those statutes. This is nuts, honestly. And, you know, this has been a bone of contention for Second Amendment advocates throughout the entirety of Trump's second term. Yes, the Civil Rights Division is doing historic work in taking on state and local gun control laws. Meanwhile, there are still forces within the DOJ that are arguing to uphold almost every federal gun control law. And in the case of the U.S. attorney in D.C., arguing to uphold municipal gun control laws as well. There is a disconnect there within DOJ, and this is another frustrating development, both yesterday and then, frankly, the arguments from DOJ last week in the switchblade case. So let's talk about it with Daniel Schmutter, at least the switchblade aspect of what I just talked about. Let's just get right to it. Take a look and a listen. Dan, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to see you today.
Thanks, Cam. It's always good to be here.
And I really appreciate all of your efforts, continued efforts in defending our rights to keep and bear arms, which recently took you to New Orleans. Is this where the oral arguments were held for the Fifth Circuit?
That's where it was, yes.
Got some
beignets and got some coffee. It's good.
Nice. Excellent. I'm glad you got to take in some of the sights and sound and cuisine of New Orleans. This is a case dealing with the Federal Switchblade Act, which bans the possession of switchblades. This is not a law, as I understand it, Dan, this is not a law that is enforced a lot, but it is a law that the federal government wants to keep in place, right?
Correct. And the big problem here is it's a law that's enforced selectively. When the Department of Justice decides they want to go after you, they'll use this law to either enforce against you, or they will use it to leverage some sort of settlement, fines, forfeitures, conduct, all sorts of things. And this is one of the issues that the court raised when at oral argument is the selective type of enforcement, the fact that they use it sometimes and sometimes don't use it. And it, you know, goes to an issue of what's called standing that your viewers may be familiar with. And so, you know, fortunately, the federal government not only has refused to disavow enforcement, they emphatically refused to disavow enforcement at oral argument. So they made it very clear they have no intention to abandon the statute. What's really insidious is they use it when they find that it's to their advantage to coerce either a manufacturer or an individual or a seller. And so it's a particularly insidious statute.
So at the district court level, the judge upheld the law, right?
Correct. And the judge didn't really even reach the merits. he looked at issues of standing. I mean, it was very odd because he held that we didn't have standing to challenge the particular aspect of the law that prohibits possession, for example, on federal lands in Indian country, as they call it in the statute. When one of our plaintiffs lives in Tulsa, Oklahoma, he's a member of the Muskogee Nation, and he lives on Muskogee tribal land. So the fact that the district judge completely missed that is really very frustrating. It's one of the very frustrating things about a generally frustrating opinion from the district court.
Yeah. So how would you describe the oral arguments last week? More or less frustrating than the opinion you got from district court?
I would say considerably less frustrating. The panel was thoughtful. It's a smart panel. It's a panel of very smart judges. Each judge kind of had something in particular in mind that they were curious about and wanted to ask about. One judge was very interested in standing, and we spent a lot of time talking about the standing issue. Hopefully we satisfied his concerns. We won't know, of course, until we see an opinion. But I think we did a good job of addressing the questions. One judge raised the issue of whether the time frame for historical analogs should be 1791 or 1868. But since this is a federal law, pretty clearly should be 1791. The 1791 versus 1868 issue only comes up because of the 14th Amendment. As you'll recall, and as your viewers will remember, because the Second Amendment is only applicable to states and local authorities through the 14th Amendment, the question has arisen whether historical analogs, and that is the historical tradition that under Bruin, a state must compare their law to if they want to uphold it, whether it should be 1868 as the time frame or whether it goes back to 1791 at the time of the founding and the framing of the Second Amendment. So that's always been an interesting issue, but here that should not be an issue because we're dealing with federal law.
Right. And that actually is a really important distinction. Do I understand correctly? I read, a couple of pieces about oral arguments. John Petrolino actually has a piece at Bearing Arms today talking about the oral arguments. Did the DOJ maintain that knives may not actually be protected by the Second Amendment?
Yes. Yeah, so at one point, the government attorney was asked, could we ban all knives? And his answer was basically yes, except for swords. They've taken a position, which is really completely untenable, that concealable knives and concealable arms can be banned, which is, of course, ridiculous, because then Bruin would have come out completely the other way. And Bruin was about carry, in particular, concealed carry, because that's what you have in New York. There's no way that Bruin would have come out favorably if concealability was a factor that would allow arms to be banned. So it's a ridiculous position. But what that position inevitably leads to, and Chief Judge Elrod picked up on this and asked the attorney from the government and said, well, could we ban all knives? And he basically said yes, and then he carved out swords because swords, I guess, aren't concealable. It's a completely nonsensical position, and it's completely inconsistent with the case law, which the test is common use. If an arm is typically possessed by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes, it's protected. It doesn't matter whether it's concealable, not concealable, or otherwise.
Does it matter how that arm operates? I mean, in terms of the protected nature, are knives protected? Are gravity-assisted knives protected? Are automatic knives protected? Where do you draw that line?
Well, you draw the line at common use. That's what's very elegant about the common use test that the Supreme Court announced and developed in Heller. You don't care. The functionality is not relevant. It doesn't matter if it opens with a thumb stud or a finger tab or automatically or by gravity or by inertia. The method of opening is irrelevant. It's the choice that the people make in keeping and bearing the arms that they deem suitable for their lawful purposes. And that's what's very elegant and simple about the common use test. It's about what the people think they should be keeping and bearing, not what the government thinks they should be keeping and bearing.
So what, let's say the panel, knock on wood, rules in your favor. Because the district court did not even reach the merits, are they likely to remand this case back down to the district court and say, no, this case actually has to proceed? Or Do you think that you, is it possible that you'll get a judgment on the merits from the Fifth Circuit?
The court raised that issue with the attorney on the other side. Because they said exactly that. They said, well, since the district court didn't deal with the merits below, should we just remand it? And both our side and their side said, you don't have to remand it. We said really that not only don't you have to remand it, you shouldn't remand it, because there's nothing that the district court can do to amplify or enhance the record for the appellate court. You know, an appellate court wants a full record from the district court, from the trial court, so okay, that they can review what happened. And so sometimes when you take an appeal to an appellate court, they'll remand to the lower, back to the lower court, because there's more to do. There are some additional facts to develop. There may be some additional argumentation, or there may be something that the appellate court would benefit from by the district court taking another shot at it. That's not the case here. There's nothing the district court can do to enhance the record. It's a simple, the record is complete. We've demonstrated common use. We've demonstrated the nature of the claims. This is a case that's fully ready for appellate decision. And we believe the appellate court can and should make a decision on the merits and rule in our favor. So there really should be no need to remand.
Okay. This case is Knife Rights versus Bondi, correct? I mean, I guess not Bondi.
Well, it was Knife Rights versus
Knife Rights
Bondi.
Versus Blanche.
Now it's right by Knife Rights versus Blanche.
Maybe in a few weeks it'll be Knife Rights versus somebody else. Okay. But, right. But Knife Rights is the plaintiff in this case. Are there individuals?
The lead plaintiff, correct.
Are there individuals who are also a part of the litigation here?
Correct. So we have Knife Rights is the organizational plaintiff.
Okay.
Which represents its members. But we have a number of individuals and entities as plaintiffs as well. We have FFLs. We have, the FFLs are particularly at risk for enforcement. You know, it's one thing, you know, when you have special licenses, you're particularly, enforcement of various prohibitions is very problematic. You know, a person may say, well, I'll take the risk. Maybe they'll arrest me. Maybe they won't. But when you've got a license, like an FFL, or if you're a lawyer, or if you're a doctor, or if you're any kind of a special licensed person or entity, you run the risk of losing your livelihood because if they either pull or fail to renew your license because of something you've done, that's the end. You're toast. So we've got a few FFLs. We've got some individuals that travel through the federal prohibited lands. We've got some outdoorsmen. We have a photographer and filmmaker that travels in the prohibited lands. As I said, we have an individual that lives in Muskogee tribal Indian land. We have some sellers of knives who go around, you know, selling various knives in various across state lines. Again, they would run afoul of the interstate commerce prohibitions on selling switchblade knives if they were to do so. So they all refrain from possessing, transporting, distributing, selling, and possessing switchblade knives, because all of them could get into serious trouble by doing so. And that gives them, that really is what gives them standing to bring this claim.
And if the act does get struck down, then the state level laws that may exist, those would need to be challenged separately, right?
Well, they would need to be, well, yes, they'd need to be challenged separately, but several of them are. So Knife Rights already has several other cases around the country, including one that was recently decided by the Ninth Circuit challenging California's law. That's Knife Rights versus Bonta out of the Ninth Circuit, and that was an unfavorable decision. So Knife Rights is pretty active on this issue in a number of places, and so a favorable decision here obviously could have an important impact around the country. And, you know, it could create a circuit split. It could create all sorts of things that might potentially get this to the Supreme Court. I mean, I don't want to jump the gun here and get ahead of myself, but there's a lot of activity on this front. Knife Rights is trying to be fairly comprehensive in its approach to this issue.
Okay. Well, listen, Dan, I really appreciate you spending a couple of minutes with us talking about this case. I've just got to ask, do you have anything else in the pipeline? Any other oral arguments that are coming up in other cases that might be of interest to our audience?
Well, two things we're waiting for, you know, with our fingers crossed, are two cases out of the Third Circuit that we may have talked about in the past. We've got two en banc arguments that recently we had in Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs versus Platkin, which is the New Jersey's magazine case, a case against New Jersey's magazine law and the so-called assault weapon law. And we've got... consolidated cases. There's a case called Coons versus Platkin, which is not my case, but then there's a consolidated case called Siegel versus Platkin. Together, those, which is my case, those are challenges to New Jersey's what they call the Bruin Response Law. So the law that the types of laws that five states came out with when they lost their minds after Bruin, you know, where they basically said, oh, well, I guess we have to issue permits, but, you know, good luck trying to use them anywhere within the state, you know, with all the sensitive places and the enhanced permit requirements and the insurance requirement and the higher fees. So our Siegel case and the companion Coons case was also argued on Bonk recently. So those are two big decisions we're looking, you know, forward to seeing. Hopefully, you know, hopefully they come out our way, you know, fingers crossed, and hope, you know, hope those make some good progress.
Yeah, absolutely. And you say recently, if I recall correctly, those were argued last fall, right?
The AJRPC case, that is the magazine and the so-called assault weapon case, were argued back in the fall. The Coons and Siegel were argued more recently, just a few months ago.
Okay.
So, you know, and then of course, obviously, you know, those sort of dovetail nicely with Walford and Himani, which we're waiting for from the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right.
So there's a lot of good stuff, hopefully good stuff that, you know, well, we hopefully can look forward to. And if it's bad, it's bad. It's good, it's good. And we'll see what happens.
Listen, I just hope we get the Third Circuit decision relatively soon. Taking the cases in order, it would be at first the magazine and ban on so-called assault weapons that might get released first. I know you recall what happened with Snope at the Fourth Circuit, where,
right,
you know, more than a year went by, no decision, and then all of a sudden the Fourth Circuit says, actually, we're going to take this case on bonk. We don't even need to hear from this three-judge panel. Thankfully, that can't happen because we're waiting for an en banc opinion to come out. But, you know, every time we get past like that 6-month mark, I just start to get a little nervous, Dan.
Well, that is what happened in the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs case. So it was argued over the summer before the 3-judge panel. And then before they rendered their opinion, the court sua sponte, that is on their own, took it en banc. So, you know, those things happen. I guess, you know, I've long since gotten out of the business of reading minds. So we can all speculate as to why they did it. You know, did they see something in a draft opinion they didn't like? You're like, there's no way to know. I mean, it's entirely possible they saw something that they didn't like in the draft opinions that was circulating, and somebody decided, you know what, this is not going to work. We need to do this on bonk. But again, pure speculation. I no longer try to guess what judges are thinking. So.
Well, hopefully we get some facts here before long, and we can have you back on the program to talk about the opinion from the Third Circuit. In the meantime, Dan, thanks again for everything you're doing. Really appreciate your time today, and I look forward to continuing the conversation here in the near future.
Thanks so much, Ken. I appreciate it.
I appreciate Dan joining us on the program, and I am keeping my fingers crossed that the Fifth Circuit reverses that district court decision. Now, before we get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report, let's talk about this for a second. From city streets to modern trails, your gear should go wherever life takes you. And that's why at Modern Rugged Leather, every bag is handcrafted from premium, responsibly sourced leather. It's designed to look sharp, last long, and tell a story of its own. Every stitch, every buckle, each strap reflecting timeless craftsmanship, and it's backed by a lifetime warranty, because quality shouldn't quit when the adventure begins. So whether it's the boardroom or the back roads, Modern Rugged Leather helps you carry confidence every step of the way. Modern Rugged Leather. Modern style, timeless durability, backed for life. Life takes you places. Make sure your gear keeps up. Shop the full collection and find yours today at modernrugged.com. Again, that is modernrugged.com. And I would add, by the way, that I love my Modern Rugged bag. It is actually over in the big house right now, not here in my office. But I also went to modernrugged.com not long ago. And, you know, they've got all kinds of other stuff besides just the bag that I use for my laptop and all of my gear. So I really would encourage you to check out modernrugged.com. A lot of great stuff there on the website. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story, good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of Milwaukee. Now, this is not a true recidivist report, but it is a what the hell are you thinking report. The headline, Milwaukee girl killed, woman sentenced for obstructing officers and sentenced to probation for obstructing officers in this case. Dariana Little, I believe is how you pronounce her name. Dariana Little, originally charged with felony child neglect, but she was ultimately offered a plea deal to 2 misdemeanor counts of obstructing an officer, 1 misdemeanor count of disorderly conduct in March, And while the judge in this case, Milwaukee County Judge David Borowski, initially sentenced Little to serve time in the Milwaukee County Community Reintegration Center, which is not a maximum security prison, the judge ended up staying that sentence and instead placed Little on nothing more than probation. Also ordered to complete 200 hours of community service as a condition of her probation. 100 of those hours to be performed at Milwaukee High School to speak about the danger of guns. Yeah, the danger of guns. This is so insulting here. It was February 1st last year. Little called 911. Dispatcher asked what the emergency was. She didn't reply. She just was screaming. And then the call disconnected. She calls back. She's still not talking to the dispatcher, but you can hear her say, "Stay with me, stay with me. It's okay. You hear me. Stay woke." And then she yelled, "Anthony, go get my baby." Anthony is Anthony Brookshire, who is Little's co-defendant in this case. He got 15 years in prison and 7 years of extended supervision after pleading guilty last December to two of the four charges against him, including second-degree reckless homicide. The other charges were dismissed as part of that plea deal. As it turns out, Little's four-year-old niece had been shot by Anthony Brookshire. Little refused to disclose where the shooting happened when police interviewed her. She claimed that Janadia Little and a one-year-old were in a bedroom when she heard a gun go off. She told police that she went to the bedroom. The one-year-old was holding a gun. After the shooting, court filings indicated that Brookshire and Little took the girl to a hospital where she passed away early on the morning of February 18th of last year. Milwaukee police detectives began their investigation, collecting evidence. They found a blood splatter near a hole in a deflated air mattress in a bedroom. They found a single bullet casing on the air mattress. They found an empty drum magazine, two empty other ammo magazines inside a backpack in the home's living room. They found a loaded handgun in plain view on the floor of a vehicle that was parked outside. They pulled three fingerprints from the gun that was in plain view. All three prints matched Brookshire. They also conducted three separate interviews with Brookshire and two with Little. According to the complaint, during the interviews, the accounts of what happened from both Brookshire and Little changed multiple times. I apologize. I said that Brookshire actually shot this child. I don't know the prosecutors actually proved that, but he did plead guilty to second-degree reckless homicide. And Little, again, absolutely obstructed law enforcement in their investigation. Whether or not they could have proved felony child neglect, I don't know. Maybe that was a case of overcharging her. But it really rubs me the wrong way that this woman, rather than coming clean and being honest with police about what happened to her niece who was fatally shot, changed her story, misled investigators, refused to answer questions, and a judge basically gave her a get-out-of-jail-free card and said, you know, you go talk about the dangers of guns. The gun wasn't the danger here. The actions of these adults were the danger. The actions of these adults were what led to the death of this four-year-old. Frankly, I don't think Ms. Little should be talking to high school kids unless they go to visit her in prison. But that's not going to happen. Instead, she gets to go talk about gun control for 100 hours, and then her sentence is served. Even Mario the Rooster is ticked off about the sentence. All right, let's get to today's Armed Citizen story from Tennessee, the Nashville area. District attorney, no charges in shooting death of Middle Tennessee State University professor. And this is kind of a wild case, I got to tell you. Some very odd circumstances here. So the shooting took place last December. A professor named Ashley McKenzie was shot and killed on December the 4th. It was on a highway. According to officials, a guy named Todd Stanton, he's 27. He's going to work. It's before 5 o'clock in the morning. It's about 4:45 a.m. And he sees McKenzie there in the middle of the road. According to police, McKenzie stepped into the path of his oncoming truck with her hands raised. He stops. Obviously, doesn't want to hit the woman, right? Then she starts coming towards the truck, and she's got a gun. Stanton told police that he thought his life was in danger when McKenzie ended up pointing the gun at him. So he ends up firing multiple shots through his windshield, striking her, and she is pronounced dead at the scene. Investigators were able to get some surveillance video from a nearby home, like a doorbell camera, that appeared to support Stanton's account, shows a person stepping into the street and then approaching the truck before they collapse. According to authorities, there was no relationship between McKenzie and Stanton whatsoever. This was just a random encounter early that morning. DA's office says that there had been concerns about McKenzie's mental state in the days leading up to the shooting. She had apparently expressed concern that an ex-boyfriend was stalking her, but there was no evidence, according to investigators, to support that claim. And as you know, you know, we take those allegations pretty seriously here. We've covered a number of defensive gun uses where women have been forced to defend themselves against their abuser. But apparently that was not the case. No evidence that her ex was stalking her, harassing her, or anything of that nature. Her current boyfriend told authorities that she had become increasingly paranoid, had purchased surveillance equipment, had purchased a handgun. According to investigators, toxicology results showed high levels of methamphetamine and amphetamine in her system at the time of her death. Again, don't know if the meth use was a one-time thing, if this was, you know, maybe what led to the paranoia. If so, she would have lied on her 4473 about being an unlawful user of drugs. And, you know, talking about the Hamani case, while I think that case, remember, specifically deals with marijuana use, right? I think we're going to get a pretty narrow decision in Hamani, but I don't think there's a majority in the court who's going to endorse meth users being able to purchase a firearm. I don't think the court is going to go that far right now. So even if Hamani had been decided and the prohibition on, you know, marijuana users under federal law being able to purchase a handgun, even if that was struck down, I suspect that the law probably would have applied to her as well. So anyway, after reviewing all of the evidence, the district attorney in DeKalb County, Tennessee, concluded that Stan's actions were legally justified, saying that the actions of Ms. McKenzie presented an imminent danger to the life of Todd Stanton. His actions in the use of deadly defensive force under the circumstances were legally justified. The case is now closed. And I feel terrible for Todd Stanton. I mean, again, you know, you're on your way to work, 5 o'clock in the morning, not even, pitch blackout, right? It's December. All of a sudden, I mean, in a matter of seconds, you see this woman stand in the middle of the road. You slam on your brakes. She starts walking towards you, points a gun at you. You know, Todd Stanton didn't ask for any of that. He was just trying to go to work, trying to put food on his table. And I'm sure that this was a traumatic event for him. I'm sure that it was a traumatic event for all of McKenzie's friends and family as well. It's a tragedy. But I am glad that Todd Stanton is alive today. I am just, I am awfully sorry that McKenzie did not get the help she needed. And apparently, her life just had spiraled, there in the days before her death. Now on to today's good deed of the day. In the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A man in North Carolina who helped save a woman who was stabbed in a Walmart parking lot. Again, a random encounter. And this one, could have turned deadly. London Green was at the Walmart with his girlfriend, Adesia Allen. They hadn't even planned on stopping there, but you know, you got to run in and get a couple of things. It's in Greensboro, North Carolina. And London Green said, as we're leaving, we heard a lady yelling, "Help, help." It was about 7:30 last Tuesday, and a woman had been stabbed there in the parking lot. Green said, "I saw her holding her neck, and there's blood rushing through her hands, and everybody's backing away from her," he said. London Green didn't know who this person was, but as WATE reports, in the middle of the chaos, he became the person she needed the most. And the minutes before first responders arrived, Green says, I guess God came over me and told me, just be the one to help. You know what to do. So go help. Linda Green is a veteran, relied on his military training, said he knew he had to put pressure on the neck wound. Another bystander gave him a paper towel. So he's, you know, doing that, trying to stop the blood flow. He said she kept saying, once I helped her, somebody call my mom. I want to talk to my mom. And Linda Green said, you know, it just made me realize, cherish people around you. He said, I don't know this lady. I just pray she's okay. She is apparently going to recover. Thanks in large part to Linda Green's actions. A 52-year-old woman taken into custody in connection with this stabbing. According to Greensboro police, this woman, Takiya Brown, allegedly stabbed a woman who was a Walmart employee after moving a shopping cart into the woman's vehicle. Brown then said something to the Walmart employee, and the employee then got out of her car. Brown is accused of using something sharp on her keychain to actually stab the employee in the neck. The woman tried to run into the store as other employees called 911. She was taken to the hospital. Thankfully, again, injuries are deemed to be non-life-threatening, but she did require surgery. Brown was found near the Walmart store, was taken into custody. She has since been charged with assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill, inflicting serious injury, being held without bond. Again, don't know if there are, you know, mental issues at play here. This seems to have escalated again out of nowhere, right? This Walmart employee in her vehicle, not even interacting with this woman. Woman runs her runs a shopping cart into the Walmart employee's vehicle, starts yelling at the employee. The employee gets out of the car, and then she gets stabbed in the neck. You know, again, from calm to chaos in a matter of seconds. And thankfully, in this case, again, London Green in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing to help a stranger in need. And we thank him for his very good deed. Now, that is going to do it for this edition of Arms, Cam & Company. I do want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. We're going to be talking with Justin Davis from NRA about these bills in Rhode Island. They may get watered down at some point, but right now, man, it's the high test stuff, right? You've heard people say, oh, nobody wants to take your guns. Nobody's coming for your guns. Well, they are in Rhode Island right now. You know, Rhode Island passed a bill a couple of years ago that banned the possession of, quote unquote, large capacity magazines, including those who lawfully purchased them and had them in their possession before the ban took effect. This was subject to litigation. Ocean State Tactical versus Nirona was the case. It was one of the cases that the Supreme Court turned away, along with Snope, last term, right? Last year. In Rhode Island, they've already said, we're coming for your magazine. I mean, we're not going door to door for them, but, you know, unless you get rid of them, unless you destroy them, you hand them over to police. If we catch you with one, we're going to charge you with a crime. Now they want to do the same thing with commonly owned semi-automatic rifles, the so-called assault weapons. If you currently possess one, if this bill passes as is, you'd be charged with a crime just for keeping it. And we know that this is the intent of gun control activists. We know this is what they want. It may not be that that's the first step they take, but it's the next step they take, right? First, you introduce the ban on the sale, the manufacture, and the transfer. After that is in place, then you go after possession, right? I mean, and it makes sense. I mean, not from a constitutional standpoint, mind you, but from a gun control standpoint, it makes sense. If you're calling something a battlefield weapon of war, doesn't belong on our streets, doesn't have a place in civil society, why would we think that they'd be okay with it? Well, but you can keep it if you already own one. That makes no sense whatsoever. So the gun control advocates and their supporters deny, right? Anybody's coming for your guns. And again, they're not going door to door. Are people coming for the magazines in Rhode Island? Are they coming for the guns in Rhode Island? No. Are they going to charge you with a crime if they catch you with a gun that you legally purchased? Yes. Do they want to put you in prison for keeping a gun that you lawfully purchased? Yes. Now, we can argue the semantics about whether they're coming for your guns or they just want to throw you in prison for keeping them. Either way, you're not allowed to have them under these laws. That's their goal. And that's what they're working towards in Rhode Island right now. As I said, maybe the bill gets watered down. But it hasn't as of yet. And I don't see any reason why we should assume that it will be. So again, we'll be talking about this with Justin Davis from NRA on tomorrow's program. And again, Thursday, Amy Bellantoni going to be with us, attorney in New York. We'll be talking about the history of sensitive places, specifically those where vulnerable populations exist, like children. An issue that came up in Schoenthal versus Raul that the Supreme Court denied cert this week. Ugh, so frustrating. We'll be talking more about that issue with Amy Bellantoni on Thursday. Between now and tomorrow, though, do check out BearingArms.com. We are keeping you up to date on all the latest Second Amendment news and information, including some other litigation from New York that is infuriating. And legislation as well. Some good news out of West Virginia, some bad news elsewhere. But we've got it all covered for you. If you like what you see, I would also encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold or VIP Platinum member. Use the promo code FIGHT. You get 60% off your membership. You'll be supporting the work we're doing at Bearing Arms, no matter what tier of support you choose. And I want to thank you for that. Have a great rest of your 2A Tuesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.